From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And the coronavirus now touches every part of life in the U.S. Schools, gyms, casinos, theaters, bars, and even restaurants are now closed in many states, with sweeping calls to shut down in places like New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. The stock market also plummeted once again after the Federal Reserve cut interest rates this weekend. For the latest, we're joined by NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. And Richard, the Centers for Disease Control recommendation says no more than 50 people should gather in one place. Why that number?
Hi, Tanya. I don't think that's a magic number. You wouldn't say, oh, it's fine just to have 49 people, but 51 tips the scales. But what we're seeing is obviously the more people crowd together, the more likely it is that infection will spread. And I will note that just last week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, when they issued guidance, said 250 was their recommendation to cities like Seattle and so on. So they have really adjusted things a lot. And I will point out this is not a blanket recommendation. It does not apply to the day-to-day operation of organizations such as schools, institutes of higher learning, or businesses. And they also say that events of any size should only be continued if they can be carried out with adherence to the guidelines for protecting vulnerable populations, which means hand hygiene and social distancing.
Yeah. The Trump administration says they're ramping up testing capabilities, but they've promised test kits before and not delivered. Could this be different this time? And how effective are these tests?
Yeah, well, it remains to be seen how different it is right now. The promises indeed have been legion. We heard a couple of weeks ago that there would be a million tests available at the end of the week. And of course, we're still nowhere remotely close to that. The American Enterprise Institute has been running a tally to figuring out how many tests can be run per day under ideal circumstances. And at the moment, they say it's 36,000 per day tests. But that assumes there's an effective way to gather those samples and to get those samples to labs. And that's really been as big a bottleneck as the ability to run these tests. So at least there are now two testing systems approved for use that can run thousands of tests simultaneously. So the technology is improving. People are working hard to get these systems in place. But I think, believe it when you see it. The demand is still so high. Obviously, even 36,000 tests a day falls pretty short.
Yeah. The president also said that Google was working on a website to help people get tested. But then Google said it was just an informational site. Do we know what's going on there?
I don't really know a lot about that, to tell you the truth. It was a lot of confusion of that over the weekend, and it's still being sorted out as far as I can tell. But let me say another word or two about the tests themselves, because you asked me how effective are these tests. And I should say that there are two things you care about when it comes to effectiveness. One is whether the test says you're infected when you're not, and the other is whether a negative test that you're really not infected. And from what I understand, from what I've been told, if you get a positive test result, that is really quite likely to be a real result. You really have been infected with the virus. But a negative test result is another matter. The test is really taken from swabs of the throat and the nose, but there's no saying that they'll pick up every virus that's in there, right? And there certainly have been cases where those swabs just miss a virus that was somewhere else, maybe like deep in the lungs. It's also possible that someone who has been tested is infected, but in fact that infection is still incubating, so the virus isn't proliferating that day, but it could proliferate the next day. So one of the lessons from public health officials is just because you have a negative test, it doesn't mean you're scot-free and you can go out and run around and assume you're not infecting other people.
Okay. I also want to ask you about something else. There's also been this tension between what the president has said and what other administrative officials have said. Anthony Fauci, for example, he's the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And this is what he said yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press.
When you think you're doing too much, you're probably doing enough or not enough.
Okay.
All right. That's the thing you've got to do. You don't want to be complacent. You always want to be ahead of the curve.
I mean, there is definitely a sense of urgency there. And I think the bigger question is, should we be seeing this from all public health officials?
Well, the answer is absolutely yes. And we are increasingly seeing it from governors and health departments around the country. And the daily briefings from the White House, the Coronavirus Task Force, has also been a good opportunity for these messages to come out, both from Dr. Fauci and another key task force member, Deborah Birx. And they've been delivering clear and urgent public health messages. But so far, the president has not shared that degree of urgency. And the real lesson of this is you really need to have clear, clean communication, and that includes having credible and accurate messengers.
That's NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. As always, thank you so much.
Pleased to be here.
Well, let's go global now. There's evidence of cases of the coronavirus on six continents. In Europe, Italy has the most cases, more than 24,000, and that country's basically on lockdown. In Germany, there are more than 6,000 cases. The BBC's Damian McGinnis joins us from Berlin. Damian, today Germany closed the border it shares with five countries. Remind us which countries and how is this going to work?
What's already happened over the past few days, Poland and the Czech Republic have already closed their borders with Germany because Germany has higher rates of corona cases than those countries. What's now happened since this morning is that Germany has closed its borders with Denmark, with France, with Switzerland, with Austria, and with Luxembourg. Now, it doesn't mean completely closed, because what still is going through, commuters are allowed to go through, German citizens from abroad are allowed to come back into Germany, and cargo, crucially cargo, is still allowed to go through because, of course, Germany needs supplies for supermarkets, for food, for everything else. So there are stringent checks on borders, but it does mean there is no free movement, because usually within this area of the EU, as you know, Robin, there is usually passport-free travel. It's like going from one U.S. state to another ordinarily. That's no longer the case.
Right. Well, a couple things. Of course, the U.S. has closed its borders. You can't fly in, for instance, from certain European countries, most of them, unless you are an American citizen returning. So it mirrors that. But I just have to ask you briefly. This comes, of course, in the wake of Brexit and what people who wanted Brexit, wanted to separate from the EU, they wanted to be able to close their borders. Now, ironically, you have EU member countries that had open borders closing theirs.
Yeah, I mean, it's a slightly more complicated situation at the moment because we're talking about very spontaneous measures to slow the rate of infection in order for Germany's health system and the logistics within the country to cope with the fact that there are going to be more deaths from corona. Yeah. So what this means is, rather than a political separation from the rest of Europe, more political working together. So we're seeing this within the EU, more political cooperation between France and Germany, for example. But at the same time, when it comes to the logistics, essentially stopping people traveling. That's the idea. Even within Germany, certain train routes are no longer running. Public transport systems are going to be slowing down over time now. And in certain parts of Germany, people are being encouraged not to leave their homes. So what we're going to see now is essentially daily life grinding to a halt, as little movement and as little social interaction as possible.
You know, we're seeing incredible pictures from Italy of people singing to each other, you know, from their apartment windows as they're closed off in cities like Rome. We're also seeing pictures from that border, really surreal, trucks backed up, traffic backed up, and people in hazmat suits walking around. What are they doing at that border?
The government in Germany certainly is trying to avoid those situations where you have trucks backed up against the border. So what is now going to happen is the authorities are going to try and make it possible, the aim is at least, to keep those supplies coming into Germany. And it's crucial that the supermarkets are served and that supplies are coming through to Germany, particularly at a time when people are going to be buying more than what they need, because people are aware there are possibly going to be more stringent conditions into going out. Already here in Berlin, for example, all bars, clubs, most cafes and a lot of restaurants have already closed. So that's limiting people's access to not only social life, but also food and drink, which means that obviously supermarkets are becoming more crucial than ever. But there is cross-party consensus here in Germany that the situation is so serious and it's so important to try to limit the spread of this disease, that's why such drastic measures are being seen as important, at least by Berlin and by the German government.
Well, that's interesting to hear, because we heard elsewhere on the program that people in France have been sort of thumbing their nose at the restrictions that were imposed on them, you know, going out and walking along the Seine in groups. You're saying in Germany people seem to be embracing this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if embracing is quite the right word, but I think there is an awareness here of how serious the situation is, because what we've seen here in Germany is people are looking to Italy, and there is an awareness here that we might just be a week or two behind Italy, in which case, when you see the numbers of fatalities and the strain on the healthcare system, people are aware that actually what is needed here are restrictions in order to limit the number of infections. Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, has become more visible as well in this crisis. And I think what we're seeing in Germany is a concerted effort to show a certain amount of unity, at least in the government. And that is so far giving a lot of people here in Germany faith that the authorities are making the right decisions for the right reasons.
The BBC's Damian McGuinness in Berlin. Damian, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Always a pleasure.
And by the way, elsewhere in the program, we touched down in France, where the BBC's Hugh Schofield told us Parisians were somewhat mocking the Italians who've been staying inside, Parisians flocking to the Seine and to cafes. But today the health ministry there rebuked them, asked them to stay inside. And it's possible there may be more of a mandate from that government before the day is over. We will stay tuned there.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
With schools shutting down across the country to stave off the spread of the coronavirus, we thought of another virus in another time that shut down everything.
This is polio, and it is something for you to remember. Polio is not over.
A film from the March of Dimes, just after the Salk polio vaccine was developed in 1955, reminding Americans that that same year, thousands were still infected by the polio virus, 50 a day in some key states.
In the summer of 1955, polio again struck hard across the nation. No swimmers or boaters where crowds would normally be in summertime. A children's playground with not a child in sight. Children were not allowed to leave their own yards.
On New York's Long Island, returning GIs like my dad were moving families into miraculous suburbs like Levittown, a community pool right at the shopping center, where my siblings and I contracted the waterborne polio. My sister and I had a painful flu that passed. My brother, some paralysis, he soaked in hot waters in a sanitarium and fully recovered. But Bill Walling, the family doctor who held and comforted us, was paralyzed for life.
Men, women, children. As always, especially children, filling hospitals with its little victims.
On the 50th anniversary of that outbreak, I joined other polio survivors and doctors at a conference at Children's Hospital in Boston. We gathered around the iron lungs that both entombed paralyzed patients and enabled them to breathe.
Oh, boy, this brings back really sad memories.
It has for me, too, because on either side of me was one of these with the ladies in them, and they didn't live.
Nearby, a beautiful older woman weeps. It's Tenley Albright, Olympic figure skater, doctor, polio survivor.
Oh, this is a very emotional day. I haven't seen an iron lung for so long, and I wasn't in an iron lung, but when I was in the hospital, I saw people who were. Well, I missed my brother so much when I was isolated in the hospital that one time my parents brought a ladder and put it up in the parking lot so he could climb up it, and then they pushed my bed so I could just look out the window and get a peek at him. So, well, isn't it interesting how vivid our memories are of this?
So what can that long-ago polio outbreak tell us about today's coronavirus pandemic? What should we know about kids and COVID-19? Dr. Howard Markell is director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. But Dr. Markell, start with the polio epidemic. What a frightening time for parents.
It really was the epidemic of their era, just like if you're my age, HIV/AIDS was the epidemic in the 80s, and now COVID-19 is. It's a real binding kind of moment for a society.
Well, just to give us some context, I was told at Children's Hospital there'd be 100 cars lined up, Woody station wagons, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With kids laid out in the back who were paralyzed.
Well, you know, polio, which the first epidemic was actually in 1916, and it was in New York City and was quite terrible. And there were several in the 30s and, of course, the 40s and the 50s. And most sadly, there was a big wave in 1955. But what was most striking about polio compared to many other infectious diseases today was that it struck children way out of proportion to adults. Poorer children who did not have access to clean running water, because polio is a gastrointestinal virus, they were probably ingesting small amounts of polio virus their whole lives and developed antibodies to it. But those kids who did not have exposure to polio were really walloped. If you're lucky, you're in an iron lung.
Yeah.
But there are other children who got it higher up in the brainstem. Those children, of course, died.
Why did it target children?
Adults did get polio. It was just those that had had antibodies to it were more immune to it. Mm-hmm. Children are only developing their immune system. You know, when they're an infant, they hardly have an immune system at all. And even under 5 years old, the immune system of that child is quite different than an older child or an adult's.
You know, you see on these old videos from the March of Dimes, beaches that were completely empty, pools completely empty.
Yeah, they even closed theaters and summer camps. And FDR was actually swimming at a Boy Scout camp a week before he was stricken at Campobello in 1920.
Yeah. So people who are feeling stress in this time can see maybe how stressful another time is, and so many people did pull through. I mean, all my siblings came out the other side with no residue, although right. I don't think my mother ever got over it. Yeah. You know, my mother had to be sent away because she was pregnant and couldn't be around her children who had polio. Just, it was a terrible, terrible time.
But think about how great it is that we have modern medicine today compared to what you're describing in the 40s and 50s.
And information. So
information,
let's get information out, because today parents are so worried about schools. So start there. We don't know that much about COVID-19, but why is it not hitting children more?
Well, we don't know. I mean, we will know later on. It seems to be hitting most heavily the elderly and those with pre-existing serious health conditions. And it may be just because it's the type of respiratory virus that causes in some adults acute respiratory distress syndrome, and that requires ventilation and intensive care and so on, that this is not something that's striking children. And I, for one, am delighted
yes,
to say that's true.
That's the good news. But how about if children are, you know, we talk about adults who might be more compromised.
Right.
But can children be more compromised? Children with asthma, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. Children with asthma. And don't forget, there are a lot more people, both children and adults, who are walking around today who would never be alive 50 years ago. People with cancer who are getting chemotherapy or radiation or immunotherapy. People with transplants. People with other immune-compromised disease. You know, and you don't really have a label when you're walking around, but those people, and respiratory diseases like serious asthma or emphysema or cystic fibrosis, those people are at risk. And that's sort of the rationale behind school closure, is that even if a kid gets it and that child has a mild disease, if he or she goes home and has a parent or a sibling who has a serious other disease, that could put them at risk.
Okay. Last week we had on Asish Jha from Harvard, who was somewhat in your camp. We have to start preparing to close schools. This is a non-pharmaceutical intervention, an NPI, something that's not medicine, but that's something that can interfere with an epidemic. And you talk about how in past outbreaks, even the 1918 influenza, the flu epidemic, you say the school closures then were one of the best firewalls.
Yes. We were really privileged to do a study with the Centers for Disease Control where we looked at 43 major American cities in 1918 to 1919. And we looked at these non-pharmaceutical interventions. So isolation and quarantine is one, public gathering bans is another, and school closures is the third. And those cities that acted early, because you have to do it early before the virus hits an inflection point and is spread and circulated throughout the town, that layered more than one of these NPI and did them for a long period of time, did far better than those cities that did not.
Okay, early. Is that right. One case? Is that one child's parent? What is that?
That's the million-dollar question. When it reached about two times the rate of flu in that particular city when compared to the year before, if you passed that point, there was no return. Yeah. But, of course, they had data from the year before of influenza and its occurrence in that city, and we don't have that for COVID-19 because it's a novel virus. So what I'm prescribing is better safe than sorry.
Well, you also studied school closings in Michigan during the wave of H1N1 flu in 2009. 83% of those closings occurred long after the virus had reached its peak week of infection, and that was too late.
Right. The virus already circulates. And, you know, I had a professor in graduate school who said, Howard, you have to remember that the first word in public health is public. And sometimes we do things for political or show reasons. You know, people complain to their leaders, don't just stand there, do something.
This is like Goldilocks, you know, don't do it too late. Don't do it with maybe just one. You've got to have a little more of a sense that there's concern. And definitely don't close schools if you haven't seen any COVID-19.
Well, yeah, you know, the history of public health is littered with health officers that acted either too early and then people complain, or too late and then people get sick or die. And to use a baseball metaphor, to hit that sweet spot, you know, you have to be basically the Babe Ruth of public health to do it absolutely right. We also have at-risk children who are actually safer in school because they may come from homeless families or they come from families where there's abuse or other bad things going on. So there's a lot of planning that needs to be done, a lot of considerations that, by the way, 100 years ago would never even enter into public health people's minds because the idea of a quarantine was to get those sick people far away from us. And there was no treatment for them anyway, so they concentrated on the healthy.
Right. And children are great carriers. Why?
Well, because they don't have – the polite term is they don't have respiratory hygiene.
Okay.
They slobber and they cough and they do things.
Oh, well, things we probably don't want to even know about. But Dr. Merkel, before we close, what else can we learn from the terrible polio outbreak that we can apply to today?
Well, what we can learn is that our predecessors have met these contagious crises with far less armaments and tools in their toolbox, and they came through on the other end. And we can do this and will do this with COVID-19.
Dr. Howard Markel, he teaches the history of medicine at the University of Michigan. Howard, Dr. Markel, thanks so much.
Oh, it's just been a delight. Thanks. I wish it would be under happier circumstances, but thanks for having me.
Well, we'll post that March of Dimes 1950s film on polio. It is incredible. And if COVID-19 is reminding you of that time or the HIV crisis, share your stories. HereAndNow.org.
Even in the midst of this global pandemic, the presidential primaries are moving forward. Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders met on the debate stage last night in front of an empty audience. Sanders slammed President Trump's response to the coronavirus.
He is undermining the doctors and the scientists who are trying to help the American people. It is unacceptable for him to be blabbering with unfactual information, which is confusing the general public.
And Biden pledged to make his cabinet reflect the demographics of the country. He also said this.
There are a number of women who are qualified to be president tomorrow. I would pick a woman to be my vice president.
Meanwhile, Georgia and Louisiana have both postponed their primaries. But the elections that are scheduled for tomorrow in Florida, Illinois, Ohio, and Arizona will go on. Illinois is the second largest prize with 155 pledged delegates. Let's check in with Tony Arnold. He's WBEZ state politics reporter in Chicago. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Tanya.
So let's start with the coronavirus. As I mentioned, the primary is still happening there. How's the coronavirus impacting it?
Well, we've heard for Chicago, for instance, that there are almost 200 places that have requested to no longer host the election tomorrow. As a result, the election officials are scrambling to find a location for people to go vote. People have, in record numbers, requested to vote by mail. I think there's a question about how fast the post office can work to get the ballots out to people, let alone have the ballots then returned in time. And early voting numbers have been way up. even higher than they were in 2016. The candidates, especially the presidential ones, each have had to cancel rallies in Illinois and redo their entire campaign strategy for how to get out the vote.
Yeah. We're seeing both former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders make the case that they're the leader to trust in this moment of crisis. They talked about that a lot during the debates. But with all of this on the minds of Illinois voters, who's got the upper hand in the state right now?
I mean, the momentum is certainly with Joe Biden, and I don't know that I've seen anything to suggest Illinois would be unique in how the trend has been going. He's been gaining a lot of endorsements from Illinois Democrats in substantial numbers ever since he won South Carolina. And while Sanders did pretty well in Illinois in 2016, he didn't win, but Clinton narrowly defeated him.
By 2 percentage points.
By 2 percentage points, exactly. And the numbers seem to suggest that right now that Biden's still ahead in Illinois.
What else has struck you about how the virus is affecting your state and really the city of Chicago right now?
Yeah, Chicago spent the weekend celebrating St. Patrick's Day. The governor and the mayor had already canceled the parades, and yet the bars were open, restaurants were open, and people went out in large numbers. As a result, the governor then closed all restaurants and bars starting midnight Monday night. So that's already been a controversial decision. I've seen both sides of from restaurant owners criticizing the governor for it, complimenting the governor for it. I think it's still going to be a few days before we know how this turns out, and as a result, people are just kind of in this limbo about how they're supposed to be living their lives.
Yes, everywhere around the country right now. That's WBEZ's Tony Arnold in Chicago. Thank you so much, Tony.
All right, thanks for having me.
Today, millions of school children are staying home for the foreseeable future in an attempt to limit the spread of COVID-19. At least 12 states, including Alabama, Illinois, Louisiana, and Washington, have all ordered shutdowns. And yesterday, Mayor Bill de Blasio announced that New York City public schools are closed effective today. Here in California, where my kids go to school, 51% of school districts are shut down, and that includes the nation's second largest school district, Los Angeles Unified Schools, where all 900 campuses are closed. Joining us now with more is Austin Buettner. He is superintendent of LA Schools, and welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Tanya.
So, Superintendent, you all decided to take this preventative step to close down for the next 2 weeks. The LA Teachers Union was calling for this last week, and I know there's so much to take into consideration here. What steps are you taking to support the students and teachers and parents and other employees during this closure?
Sure. Our focus at this time is really three things. The first is to provide continuity of learning for students. And we could talk more about that. The second is to make sure we're supporting our students and families most in need. And we want to make sure we also support our employees. We employ more than 75,000 people who help support their families. They're also the front line supporting our students. So all three of those, we're making our priorities at this time.
I can imagine that it takes a lot to build that continuity and curriculum for home learning. That's just a process just in itself.
Sure. And we started sort of from both ends. We started with those who were on a one-on-one plan with a classroom teacher. We have a platform Schoology. We will continue to do that work, distance learning of a sort. We started at the other end, recognizing we serve a very high needs population, more than a quarter of whom don't have access to the internet at home, one way, shape, or form. So we've created a partnership together with PBS where we have three channels of content, deep and rich, standards aligned content. One channel for K-3, one channel for middle school, one channel for high school, with great learning to be had, perhaps by the student, together with a family member as a way to bond, as a way to maybe reduce some anxiety during this time of stress.
Sure. We're reading that of the nearly 700,000 LAUSD students, 80% rely on free or reduced lunches, and at least 18,000 are homeless. You've said food and other resources will still be available for that student population. Can you break down how that will work?
We need to continue to provide that social safety net for those students and families who are living in poverty, and also recognize that many students in our school system are children of hospital workers, public safety personnel, first responders. So we feel a responsibility to make sure those students are safe if we can help, to provide nutrition if we can help, and we're working feverishly with state and local authorities to be able to do that.
What safety precautions are being set up at these resource centers to make certain that the workers and students are limiting contact while they're also receiving those meals?
So separate the ability to provide a meal, which we can do in a grab-and-go sort of approach where the meals can be brought in, they can be pre-packaged, we can send an individual, a child, home with a couple meals for the day. We can do that quite safely with the help of Red Cross and others. We're not yet certain we can deliver on our goal, which is to also provide care for a child during the course of the day, because the protocols and advice from the CDC and state and local authorities is changing. So we're reviewing what we had put in place. We will not open those family resource centers unless we're convinced it will be safe for the adults and the children in those centers. Our goal had been Wednesday. We'll have more to share during the course of the day today and tomorrow as we review the further guidance from health authorities. But we're bounded by their expertise and what they tell us is safe and appropriate and how we do that.
Right, of course. What factors will you consider in the 2 weeks' time where these kids are out of school to reconsider opening? I know a lot of it has to do with what you just mentioned and taking the cue from medical professionals.
Yeah, so when we announced closure, we said for the next 2 weeks, with more information to come. We did not establish a date certain to reopen. I don't know that we can do that accurately at this point in time. I don't have a crystal ball, so we're going to continue to listen carefully to the state and local health authorities, and we will not reopen our school campuses until we're convinced they're safe for not only our students, but our families, our staff, and visitors on those campuses.
What tips do you have for parents and caretakers as they go through this to help keep their children stay engaged but also safe?
So we are fortunate to have the support of our 75,000 employees to trying our best to support our students remotely. So we can connect them, we are, where we can model behavior about this is going to have to be a different normal for a while. One of the reasons we're proud of the work we're doing with PBS is a way to create a new normal in a home setting. So a student might finish their one-on-one learning or their unique assignment on Schoology and AP Calculus, but then sit down with a sibling or a family member and take in some other types of learning, because it's going to be different. And we know for so many of our students and families, the school is the center of their life. We know the adults in school are mentors, counselors, friends, more than just teachers. So that disruption in their lives causes further anxiety. We're trying to do our best to make sure we can help be a source of information, be a source of clarity, and be a source of some normalcy by continuing to connect students and their families with the school community.
That's Austin Buettner, superintendent of LA schools. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
As you heard, many schools are working to make certain students are fed, but they're not the only ones. In San Antonio, Texas, a local food bank that serves 60,000 people a week is also trying to help. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie reports.
There's a small waiting room at the San Antonio Food Bank where people come to sign up for food assistance. Today, it's empty except for a staffer and Carol Lisette Castilla, who's filling out forms. Like most Americans, she has coronavirus on her mind.
It is kind of worrying because when you have kids, you always think about them first, you know, and the mom can always wait, but not the kids.
She's heard the food bank might be able to help with her coronavirus necessities list.
Sanitizers, wipes and stuff like that, canned food like tuna, you know, stuff like that that's already prepared.
On the other side of the building, scattered volunteers and food bank president Eric Cooper are hard at work.
So this is the room where we pack the boxes and get them ready to go out to families.
Cooper says their clients, low-income families and fixed-income older folks, are vulnerable in a time of crisis.
They don't have a pantry full of food. Their refrigerator's empty, and the thought of being prepared for a crisis like this can be overwhelming.
Not only can't they stock up on food, but public benefits like SNAP don't cover non-food supplies like hand sanitizer and wipes and bleach. So the food bank is putting together what Cooper calls prevention and preparedness packages.
Which is a little bit more food than we would normally give, with more non-food items like those cleaning supplies that we think can really help those families.
To make this happen, Cooper estimates they'll need 15 million extra pounds of goods, donations of food and money. And one more thing.
We're standing in our sorting room, and there's some amazing volunteers, but to be honest, this room's usually packed. We've seen a decline in some of our volunteers showing up.
It's not because San Antonio has suddenly become a less altruistic city. Cooper says volunteers, too, are afraid of the virus. It's become an issue for food banks across the country, especially in places like Seattle, as more people stay home. Those sorting food in San Antonio today are, so far, undeterred.
I'm going to have sanitizers all over through here, so no, we're not even worried about that at all.
One of them's connected their phone to a guitar amp, and Richard Poley is jamming out to the music as he sorts. So I ask him, what if coronavirus starts to spread in San Antonio?
I would still come. Yeah, no, as long as I can help. I mean, I was in the military, so I mean, as long as I'm kicking, as long as I'm breathing, I'm going to, like, fight the good fight, so.
Food Bank President Eric Cooper says in the event of some sort of quarantine in the city, they'll need a lot more volunteers to get food to people who need it.
Many of our distributions are mobile. They're in urban and rural settings. They might be in a parking lot. We do drive-throughs. And so those are all the strategies that we'll be invoking to try to get people food.
Which is all quite reassuring to San Antonio Food Bank client Carol Lisette Castilla.
And it gives like peace and rest, you know.
The San Antonio Food Bank hopes to distribute 300,000 prevention and preparedness packages over the next month.
So what to make of the fact that everything is closed, theaters and museums across the country, in New York, Broadway and dance performances? Let's bring in New York Times dance critic Siobhan Burke. And Siobhan, we originally had planned to talk to you because of your intriguing backstory. You were a teenager dancing in Riverdance, and you wrote about that recently. We will get to that. But how is, you know, your field receiving this news?
My sense personally is that it's the right thing to do. It will be obviously difficult for people, for performers, for administrators and everything. But personally, I'm a little bit relieved because it means that I don't have to make the choice about whether to go to the theater or not.
I hadn't thought of that.
Which I've had to do a couple of times.
Ah, but one of the shows that you had to go see was the new Riverdance in New York. And it is something of a celebration of 25 years of this Irish dance spectacle. So let's take a listen. Okay, so people who are in New York who had intended to see Riverdance, we're going to give you a little taste there. And others get to remember the red-haired Gene Butler and Michael Flatley, who brought new energy to this traditional dance form. It used to be an intermission act, we understand, in the 1994 Eurovision Song Contest. But it just, he pole vaulted it into this stage show. Just remind people what kind of a show it was.
I mean, the world really didn't know very much about Irish dancing. This kind of gave it a sexier image, incorporated the use of the upper body, which isn't done in traditional Irish dance. Again, just put it on a global stage in a way that it hadn't been before.
Well, mainly because of him and the muscular approach he brought to this. He was kind of the Rocky of, you know, Irish dance. And you mentioned the different cultural touchstones. There's Chandler in the 1998 episode of Friends.
According to Chandler, what phenomenon scares the bejesus out of him?
Michael
That is correct.
Marge in The Simpsons dreams of a Catholic heaven with rows of angels, you know, dancing to Riverdance.
Now dance, you heavenly gobs!
Because of Michael Flatley, he became a character but then caricatured.
Yeah, he was a character. And I have to say, personally, I mean, you can't underestimate his skill. He was an incredibly talented dancer.
You know, if you ever turn on PBS, I mean, for years at a time, there he was, you know, doing it. Now, you're 9 when you first saw it, also at Radio City Music Hall, where the new version was until it was canceled. You'd been studying Irish dance. You'd had your hands scotch taped down by your side to make sure that you, you know, kept them straight down there while your feet did all sorts of wacky things. What happened to you when you saw it?
I was just really inspired. I mean, Riverdance doesn't really tell a story, but there is like kind of like a loose narrative. So I think I saw that it just could be, it could be expressive in a way that I hadn't seen previously.
Well, then your freshman year in college, you get a chance to be in Riverdance, a touring company, 10 years later. Now, we should say that you ended up kind of thinking, wait, this is too much. You get up every night, as you wrote, act it, perform it, ham it up, be a big darn cornball, not the word darn. But it started to wear on you after a while. But initially, when you're up there and there's all these bodies doing the same exact thing you are, what did it feel like to be in it?
You know, it was exhilarating to be in it. And I've been reminded of this in recent days, revisiting choreography from the show gives me chills, and I've been remembering how exhilarating it was to be on that stage, part of this group, you know, working together in front of such a large audience and kind of having to deliver this very precise choreography.
Let's listen to a little more from Riverdance. This is Countess Kathleen. Again, what people might be hearing if they were able to go to Riverdance at Radio City Music Hall, but it, along with everything in New York on stage, has been canceled. But Siobhan Burke, you say that even when you see a billboard, it triggers you. It's, you know, this, oh, I love that. Oh, no, I don't.
Yeah, it's definitely even just the sight of a billboard brings back a lot of memories and mixed feelings.
So, Siobhan, would you recommend that if the show opens, should people go see the new Riverdance?
People should absolutely see the new Riverdance. The show has been revamped. It has these new video projections. But most of all, I felt that the dancers were just really spectacular. They were giving their all in a really beautiful way. And not just the Irish dancers, but flamenco, Russian, tap dancers. Mm-hmm. There are all these different forms in the show. And the performances were just really heartfelt. So I do recommend that people go.
Well, until then, we can dream. Siobhan Burke, yes. New York Times dance critic. A decade ago, a dancer with the Riverdance Touring Company, which has now gone dark along with all of New York because of COVID-19. But again, you can listen here. Siobhan, thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
And I just got an email. Riverdance canceled on its tour stop here in Boston. So much for that. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.